We are pursuing this theme of the 21st century Bodhisattva. So how can we, in our own practice, have this perspective of, in some way, following the Bodhisattva path, and particularly do so in relationship to the world we find ourselves in? What does it look like? What does it look like for us in our lives, in our environment, to pursue this altruistically orientated style of Dharma practice? And in her first talk, Saravantu introduced these so-called Shambhala warrior mind training verses, which Akapa put together. And I'll read out two of these verses. Put down the leaden burden of saving the world alone. Join with others of like mind. Align yourself with the forces of resolution. Hold in a single vision, in the same thought, the transformation of yourself and the transformation of the world. Live your life around that edge, always keeping it in sight. I'll repeat those. Put down the leaden burden of saving the world alone. Join with others of like mind. Align yourself with the forces of resolution. Hold in a single vision, in the same thought, the transformation of yourself and the transformation of the world. Live your life around that edge, always keeping it in sight. So the theme today is something to do with this relationship between personal practice and practice more broadly within society. How does our personal practice affect the society around us? And many years ago, Sangharakshita gave a series of talks entitled Transformation of Self and World, which was a series of talks on the Sutra of Golden Light. But this theme of transformation of self and world has been dear to him for a long time, since, as far as I can tell, since his time in India, when he got involved in the conversion of the Dalits to Buddhism. And I'll start off talking around that kind of area, because the title of the talk is Liberty, Equality, Fraternity. It's very interesting being given a title. I didn't have any kind of sense of what on earth I might say speaking to the title of Liberty, Equality, Fraternity. And the reason that within this series of modules on the 21st century Bodhisattva, Akupa gave a module entitled Liberty, Equality, Fraternity is not due to the French Revolution, but because this was the calling cry, if you like, of Dr. Ambedkar, which he said didn't come from the French Revolution, it came from his master, the Buddha. So I'll say a little bit about Liberty, Equality, Fraternity, but not very much, and I'll say a little bit about why I'm not going to say very much. I'm a rebel, I know. But I will say a little bit about Dr. Ambedkar. I'm sure most of you have heard of him, but for those of you who haven't, he was born in those days what was called an untouchable in India, so not even the lowest stratum of the caste system. He was literally an outcast. The untouchables are outside the caste system, the lowest of the low. He was born in 1891, and he had a very, very unusual, remarkable schooling. Well, he went to traditional schooling, but he was sort of picked out as unusually bright, given a bit of a bursary to go to a better school, ended up going, getting a PhD both from Columbia University and from the London School of Economics. Not your average trajectory for a an untouchable, the next untouchable in those days. Came back to India, and in the independent Indian government, he was the first law and justice minister and was responsible for drafting what is still an extraordinary constitution. The Indian constitution is extraordinary, if only they could uphold it. He fairly rapidly lost hope in politics, in being able to change the societal position of his community, of his ex-untouchable or Dalit community. And he looked for a religion to convert to. He chose Buddhism. And in 1956, he converted. He took the refuges and precepts from, in fact, the monk who ordained Bhante. And then he turned around and he converted 400,000 of his followers in one fell swoop, and then died 6 weeks later. And it was Sangrajita who sort of picked up, in a way, from where he left off for a while. He encouraged the followers who were completely heartbroken and set something in motion, or gave some momentum to what was had been set in motion by Dr. Ambedkar. So, as I said, Dr. Ambedkar chose, well, one of the reasons he chose Buddhism, it was not for his own uplift. He was definitely looking for the uplift of his whole community. He saw that there's no way that his community could benefit within the Hindu system. So they had to convert out of the Hindu system, had to change religion. So this, it was never a personal project for him. He was never pursuing just this path of self-development. From the very beginning, it was a path to change society. And that's a little bit in contrast, probably, to the way we tend to see what we're doing. I don't want to speak for everyone, but certainly when I came along to Buddhism, I was in it for my own benefit. I was trying to find some kind of meaning in life, trying to find some kind of way of aligning myself with something a bit more meaningful, really. It never occurred to me that this might be something that I use to impact on the society around me. Sangrajita has said that, in fact, I think I've got a quote from him somewhere. This is a talk in which he was remembering Ambedkar. He says, "I sometimes contrast the position and attitude of the new Buddhists living in the West, especially in Great Britain, with the background and attitude of the new Buddhists in India. Here in the West, we are much more concerned, it seems, with our subjective psychological state, with our feelings. The people who became Buddhists in India, the Dalits, for them the point of departure was social. They saw Buddhism, which was critical of the caste system, as the key to their social, economic, and even their political uplift, as well as their spiritual path. You may say that here we go from the psychological to the spiritual, but there they go from the social to the spiritual. Because you need to have them both, you need to balance the two. I certainly think that perhaps order members, mitras and others in the West could pay a bit more attention to the objective and social issues rather than to their own subjective feelings. I hope that we can learn a bit of a lesson from our friends in India, who are very much concerned with the social, economic and other such issues. We must have a balanced spiritual life." So I said that Ambedkar's slogan for the kind of society that he's trying to create, or the values of the kind of society he's trying to create, were liberty, equality and fraternity. And we probably can't really argue with those as a set of values. But I want to do a little bit of a loop, I've, and this almost became the whole of my talk, but I'll try and keep this short, because I've got an interest at the moment. I've recently been reading this book by a guy called Jonathan Haidt, called The Righteous Mind, which is about moral psychology. So the psychology of how we hold moral values. And he quotes a guy called Schrader, who came up with three main clusters of moral values. So one cluster he calls the ethics of autonomy. So here we see an individual as the most important unit, if you like, the most important thing. And so when we take individuals as foremost, we have the basic attitude that individuals should be able to pursue their preferences, their likes, their wants, not be unjustly inhibited from that unless they come into conflict with other individuals, and you know, then you have to negotiate. So there's a whole language there of rights, of liberty, of justice, these kinds of concepts which try to preserve the values of the individual. So you might be thinking, well, what else is there? Because that's so much what we lead in the liberal democracies of the West. So he identifies two others. He identifies a cluster of communal ethics. So with communal ethics, with community ethics, the unit of importance isn't so much individual as a collective one. It might be the family, might be the village, might be the tribe, might be the football team, might be the country. So these are the kind of institutions which are seen as most valuable. And when that's your kind of ethic, then we have a whole different set of values, values of duty, of hierarchy, of respect, of patriotism, which is seen as very important, and which to us can feel a little bit reactionary, maybe. And then there's this third cluster of values he identifies, which, broadly speaking, he calls divinity, the ethics of divinity, where the human being is seen as, well, we have to put this in different ways for ourselves, probably, but he was talking about it as a vessel of the divine, for example. We might want to see the human being as capable of awakening, as holding Buddha nature. But there the human being, the human body, for example, is not a playground. It is it's a vessel, it's a temple, you could say. And so when you hold this kind of set of cluster of ethics, you have concepts such as sanctity and sin, and purity and pollution, and elevation and degradation. And from this perspective, our Western liberal ethics can look very libertine and hedonistic. So I think it's worth remembering the kind of society that Mbeki and his followers were living in. They were living at the sharp end of these ethics, firstly of the community. They had a very definite place in the community right outside of it, the very lowest place in the community, so to speak. And they had this divine, well, within the ethics of the divine, they were polluted. They were not just polluted, but polluting. They were polluting of anyone outside of their outcast status. So that's a pretty rubbish place to find yourself. And I don't think it's surprising that Mbeki chose the ethics of autonomy to address the place that he found himself in and his followers found themselves in. So I just find that's interesting as a piece of perspective. I think within, sort of, as I say, Western democracies, we probably lead pretty strongly with liberty, equality. Maybe not so much fraternity. We can always do with a bit more fraternity. of course we can do with more liberty and more equality. And I'll say a little bit about those. So liberty is, of course, an area where one could say an awful lot. Do we mean liberty to? Do we mean being able to do something, the freedom to lead the kind of life we want to lead? Do we mean the freedom from? Of course, within Buddhist context, liberty is a freedom from the afflictions, a freedom from being in a reactive, being driven reactively by unconscious conditioning, by sanskaras. So there's a whole much vaster framework within a Buddhist context of what liberty might mean. But in a societal context, maybe what we can take on board in terms of liberty is a real scrupulousness about living from the love mode, which is a whole kind of spectrum of a whole spectrum of subtlety. Sangharakshita says it's a whole path. If we can see the whole path of the Dharma as living more and more according to the love mode. So that's spurning any kind of manipulation, subtle guilt tripping, passive aggression. There's a whole kind of world of subtle levels at which we can use the power mode. And of course there's the way in which we might use the power mode deliberately at the service of the love mode, which is a whole big topic around there, which I won't go into. So yeah, in terms of liberty, maybe we can think in terms of really taking the application of the love mode to deeper and deeper places. And then in terms of equality, Bhante is not very keen on equality. He says equality is a concept that has a place only in arithmetic. But I think we can't argue either with Ambedkar's conception of equality, which is equality of opportunity. So not placing unnecessary prejudiced barriers in the way of other people. He wasn't saying that everyone's born equal in the sense of equally competent or equally able in all ways. But there's the basic idea of removing any obstructions, any unnecessary obstructions for people to live out their potential. And from a deeper Buddhist place, we can always take the wisdom of Ratnasambhava, the wisdom of sameness, which is the wisdom that sees all beings as basically the same, in as much as to the extent that any being has a potential for well-being or pain, we recognize that deep wish, we recognize their deep wish for well-being, and we relate to them from that perspective. And fraternity, of course, is the spirit of metta. It's the spirit that enlivens the other two qualities of liberty and equality. They're sort of rather dead concepts, if we're not careful, or sort of political slogans, if it's not enlivened with the spirit of metta. In the fifth stage of the metta bhavana, which in the second half, we're going to do a meditation practice focusing on the fifth stage. The final stage is sometimes called breaking down the barriers, trying to break down the barriers that we create in our own mind between different types of people. And this is really this is where the fraternity is going towards, breaking down all the barriers, whether it's barriers between human beings, between our attitude to any other types of human beings, or even barriers between different types of species. So I want to ask a few questions, because I've been wondering about these questions, and I don't have an answer, so I thought I'd just throw them out to you and see what you make. So, as I said, liberty, equality, fraternity happens also to be drawn from the French Revolution. So, does Buddhist ethics naturally lead you towards a more left-wing approach, a more left-wing affiliation? So this is a question I've had for myself for a while, because I think it can be quite easy for Triratna centres to have a kind of subtext of kind of broad left-wing sentiment, which we don't notice unless we walk in with more right-wing leanings, more conservative leanings, at which stage the skin starts prickling and you sort of hear statements uttered as completely taken for granted, which run straight against your own attitudes. So do we unnecessarily create a hostile environment for people with a more conservative leaning? Do we limit our reach because of a broad political affiliation? Or is it just inherently in Buddhist ethics that people will naturally tend towards the left? So I've been wondering about that. Maybe you can discuss that later. I was also interested to read, when I was looking up liberty, equality, fraternity, that during the period of the occupation of France in the Second World War, so you might know that the southern part of France wasn't occupied by the Nazis, it was ruled over by Marshal Pétain, who was a sort of French puppet of the Nazis. And he changed their slogan from liberty, equality to fraternity to work, family and country. Which we might think is good, solid, reactionary qualities, which do, of course, lead themselves they do come straight from that community aspect, the community cluster of ethics. And what I find interesting about those values, so it wasn't countries, fatherland, work, family, fatherland. And what I find interesting about comparing those with liberty, equality, fraternity, is those are concrete. They're really concrete values. You know what you're talking about when you're talking about work, family, and country. We sort of know what they look like. Liberty, equality, fraternity are much more abstract. So I think that's some place where that's my perspective anyway. What do they look like? So I was finding that curious, that there's something about, from my point of view, I think to the degree that we're trying to espouse these more, what I would say, idealistic values, we have to struggle more against abstraction. Again, you can argue with me about that. Okay, so I mentioned that I believe Sangharakshita's interest in societal change came from his contact with Ambedkar. And fairly early on, when he came back to the West, he started talking about this notion of the new society, which I think might have been borrowed from Ambedkar. So this is, I think, the starting point, if you like, the doctrinal starting point of what it might look like for us to take on board the necessity to engage with the broader society. So I'll quote from Sangharakshita here. In what does the extension of the FWBO consist, the Triratna consist? So he's asking about why are we trying to grow, basically. It doesn't consist in the publicising of a personality, not in the popularisation of an idea, but in the growth of a new society and a new world. Which is very lofty, isn't it? This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to grow a new society, a new world. So this is trying to counter the idea that we're trying to grow a nice little cosy group of mates who we come and relate to every Wednesday. It's certainly true that we're trying to do that. We are trying to grow a group of friends. We are trying to grow a group of friends who relate on the basis of the Dharma and who relate more and more intimately and deeply with each other. But we do that for a reason, or at least that in itself is a reason, and there's a broader reason. We are trying to act as the nucleus of a new society, which is a remarkable thing to talk about. This was Sangharakshita was talking about this in maybe the 70s, maybe even a little bit earlier, when people were very idealistic. And I was just noticing for myself, this language has fallen off the map a little bit, I think. I don't think I think in these terms. I sort of do, in as much as I've got this sense that the Triratna Buddhist order and the Triratna Buddhist community is always trying to extend itself. You know, it has this idea of always wanting to be more and more inclusive, wanting to bring more people in through the door. And not just so that we feel successful, but because we are trying to bring the benefits to more and more people. And to be honest, I think that's about as far as I tend to go. I think I've lost the sense of really expecting to have a big impact on society. So this has been a very useful wake-up call for me. I was interested to receive a little summary from Saravantu about the chairs meeting recently. She had typed up a few little quotes or a few little notes from there. And someone had said, "What the world needs, even more than remarkable individuals, is a culture of friendship, a culture of Kalyanamitrata, of spiritual friendship." And that really struck me because I think I tend to think what's most important in Dharma life is to become a remarkable individual, is to transform oneself into a Buddha. You know, that's the idea, really, isn't it? We're trying to become Buddhas. And that can sort of go off into a bit of an individualistic direction. You know, what's most important is my practice and getting on with my practice. And this is saying actually what the world really needs is a culture of spiritual friendship. A culture of friendship based in spiritual values. And sure enough, we need some remarkable individuals to bring that about. Otherwise, the spiritual community just becomes a community. It's sort of the spiritual vision dies out over time. So we need remarkable individuals, but we also need foot soldiers, so to speak. We just need people who can be friendly, pretty rooted in their spiritual practice, doing their best and helping other people do their best as well. We mustn't despise that level of practice, I don't think. I mustn't, anyway. So how do we build this idea of a new society? Well, in the olden days, we talked to the three C's. Community, so residential spiritual communities, centres, and co-ops, which now get called team-based right livelihoods. So Buddhists working together in a common project. And I'm afraid to say, Shrewsbury just has the one of them. It has a centre. We don't have any communities. We don't have any team-based right livelihood businesses. Is that a problem? Is this an old model? I don't know. But what I do know is that the spiritual friendships within the order today were largely based in the intensity that arose from communities and from team-based right livelihoods. There's a certain kind of intensity that comes through living together and working together on objective projects. How our new model evolves, I really don't know, but I'm pretty confident that we need intensity of living together, of working together, at least for periods of time, so that we encounter each other not just on our Wednesday night best, not just with our happy Buddhist face on, but when we're miserable, when we're arguing, when we're up against each other, when we really can't understand what on earth the other person's going on about and why they hold the values they hold. It's this kind of intensity that really starts challenging our own views, really starts bringing us up against our own deeply held sangskaras. And I know for myself, my biggest moments of change, you know, there's been a few step changes, and they've always happened when I've come right up against a completely insoluble problem, a problem that in myself was insoluble. I came up against my hatred, or I came up against my doubt, and it's like I couldn't see anywhere to go with that. And the intensity of being in the pressure cooker is somehow that's what does the alchemy of the transformation. So there's another question. How do we bring about this level of intensity in our current lives? So what I want to do for the rest of my talk, maybe 10 minutes or so, is basically summarise another talk, which was given by Subhuti, who was one of Sangharakshita's main disciples, still is, which he called, it was two talks in fact. They were giving it an order weekend in Padmaloka, which I was at, some of you might have been there, a men's order weekend, entitled Dhamma Revolution. And there was one talk called Dhamma Revolution East and one talk called Dhamma Revolution West. So he was referring to what Dr. Ambedkar started as a Dhamma Revolution. They call it that in India now, the Dhamma Kranti. They really see what they're doing as creating a revolution, a peaceful revolution. And in it he was talking about how in Maharashtra, which is one area of India where Charitna is very strong, this extraordinary situation has come about where Dalit, in other words, ex-untouchable men, are very desirable matches for Brahmin women. Now, for anyone who knows anything about Indian caste system, this is completely extraordinary. It is such an unrecognisable state of affairs. And the reason is that what we call the new Buddhists, who have converted out of being Dalits, the new Buddhists are seen as very marriageable because they have taken responsibility for their lives. What the Dharma has brought to them is this real sense of personal responsibility that if anything's going to change, I'm going to have to be one who does that change, who makes that change. And of course, it's not just me, it's my whole village or what have you. So there's this collective culture of taking responsibility for one's own karma, basically. And this has led to people becoming quite successful in business, holding up pretty good jobs. Plus, they don't drink, which is a big thing. They're basically, they don't beat their wives, which is a big thing. So they've got this reputation for being good husbands. So this is just a little snippet of what the Dhamma Revolution looks like over there. So how do we apply the Dhamma Revolution to the West? It probably doesn't look like becoming more marriageable. So far, I think you could say that what we've managed is we've appealed to that few percent of society, maybe 1% of society. In the last census I saw, 1% were Buddhists. It might have changed since then. So we appeal to a very small percentage of people who respond to a poster that says meditation Buddhism. And you've all done it. Well done. There's a lot more people out there who don't respond to that. It's like it's just not even on their map. In particular, there's a whole swathe of society which you could call disadvantaged or marginalised. Our equivalent of the Dalits. We don't have to go very far here to find them. Not even beyond Castlefields. So what on earth do we have to offer to that large swathe of the population? And I say it's a large swathe because I think the trajectory we're on, neoliberal economics on the one hand, works. You know, it operates on the basis of increasing inequality. We're seeing that happening more and more. Inequality has been increasing steadily since the 1970s. Plus, there's this whole other joker in the pack called automation, which is going to make increasing numbers of people not have any hope of employment. We've got no idea how to deal with this. Plus, I was just reading in The Guardian yesterday, a survey, between 16 and 25-year-olds, young people, one in five people say they don't think life is worth living. And that's doubled in the last 10 years. So there's something that's going horribly wrong in our society. We know that, I'm sure. How do we appeal to them? I'm sure that the Dharma has got things to say. We have to be intelligent about how we find out what people's interests are, what causes the suffering that they're experiencing, how can the Dharma talk to that suffering? How do we actually get out there in the first place? They're probably not going to walk in through the door here. So there's a whole kind of project for those who want it, of getting out there, of finding ways to talk more broadly, to use the language that will appeal. And of course, it's already happened to some extent with the language of mindfulness, and more recently, compassion-based therapies and so on. But we do have what they need. We do have the Dharma. We do have an understanding of the karma. We have an understanding of what makes life worthwhile. And that is what's needed for everyone. So that's one segment of the population that Subhuti points out is completely underrepresented. And then the other segment that he talks about is society as a whole. So this isn't saying, okay, we've got to convert the whole of society to Buddhism. What this is saying is that we need to bring the Buddhist discourse into the mainstream of society. So we need to make sure that where there's discussions happening, the Dharma somehow or other gets represented. So you probably know, or you may know, that Vishwapani, an Order member, very regularly appears on Radio 4 in his Thought for Today. Just gets this little sort of nugget of a Dharma perspective in there. And then, of course, we just finished Viganyari. I have a confession here. So I was listening to a Radio 4 programme yesterday again on You and Yours, mainstream radio programme. Please phone up if you've done Viganyari and tell us if you're going to carry on being vegan. And I thought, oh, I could phone up, couldn't I? So I'm listening to all these people phoning up and saying, you know, giving their perspective on veganism. No, I've given it up, or yes, I'm going to carry it on. And this being a daytime programme, every single of the callers was a woman. And I thought, oh, I could call up as a bloke just to show it's not a woman's occupation. And there I'm listening, and then I kind of don't. And I thought, this is exactly the kind of thing that you can do. Now, I could have phoned up, I could have made a fool of myself, I don't know. Just bring a little Buddhist voice in, just to address one or two of the points which had come up before, and I failed. May you do better than me. So that's the second area. And then the third area is basically what we're already doing. The people who really do aspire to some kind of deeply dharmic life. We can always do more with that, of course, but there's always further to go in terms of intensifying the Sangha that we create here in its depth and its breadth. But I think this brings in if we see these three things, the marginalised people, society as a whole, which includes, of course, engaging in politics, local politics, Sangrechta recommends, rather than party politics, and intensifying our own situation here. If we can do that, then we've really got something to offer the world. I'll just give you a little reading here. This is a quote from Sangrechta. I do not want to see little pockets of Buddhism here and there, with the remainder of society completely unchanged. I don't want there to be just little Buddhist oases in the midst of the desert of secular life. I want them to spread and to influence their surroundings in a positive way. So this is the vision of the new society. And to do that, yes, we need to create something very special within ourselves. We need to create a culture within our own society, within our own subculture, if you like, within our own new society here, which is an exemplification of what broader society could be. This is one of the visions of the new society we can exemplify. This is what Triratna is. Triratna is the nucleus, Sangharakshita calls it the nucleus of a new society. So we can, like a crystal being put into liquid, it can sort of crystallize out something patterned on our own dharmic vision. So what I'll do is I'll finish off with a short poem. This is by a Sufi poet called Divani Nurbach. And then I shall invite us to just talk over in little groups anything that might have piqued your interest. This is called The People of Loving Kindness, because I think what we're trying to do here is create a people of loving kindness. We are the people of loving kindness, leaders and guides of one another. From the purity of love's footstep, we are helpers of one another. Though in body separate, we are all but one spirit. Soul and spirit, heart and possessor of hearts of one another. We are all one people, without you and I, only we. All equal, all love, all beloveds to one another.